Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello, and welcome to the International Schools Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by John Micton and Mark Dilworth. John's already becoming a regular guest, stroke presenter on the podcast. Mark is the IT director at Zurich International School, who I've known for quite a few years. So Mark and John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, just a bit of introduction to you. I guess you haven't been here before. Can you just give a quick overview of kind of your background and what you're up to in Zurich?
One of my responsibilities at Zurich International School is to be the data protection lead. So we've been doing a lot of work within the school with our faculty and with different teams across the school to prepare them for the GDPR launch last year. And also just to make sure that we're aware of what we're doing within our own organization.
Great. And what about your background? I mean, how long have you been in Europe, and what did you do before?
I've been an international teacher working in international schools for almost 20 years now, and I've worked in the Middle East, Asia, and now Europe, and been here at Zurich for just over a decade, working with IT, library, data protection.
I didn't know that. Actually, whereabouts in the Middle East were you?
Started my career in Bahrain, and I also spent some time in Abu Dhabi.
Okay, great. I've been to Abu Dhabi. I'm actually speaking to a guy I've known for quite a while who lives in Bahrain. He does some work with the British University or the British College out there. It's higher education. And yeah, talking about doing some stuff. But it's Bahrain's a fascinating place, you know, like really interesting. Just, you know, very different from a lot of the other countries around there, I think.
Yeah, it's a small island with a lot happening.
Yeah. Guys, great. So today we're going to have a quick chat about GDPR, which is the European Union General Data Privacy Regulations. And it's a kind of an acronym that strikes fear into anyone's heart who hears it, not just somebody working for a school, because I think a lot of this is relevant to any business. I mean, even if I take Apps Events, you know, I'm constantly worrying about if our website is GDPR compliant in terms of the data. So it's something that everyone is thinking about. So I think the great thing is, maybe John, you've got a great slide here where you talk in a nutshell about what is GDPR. So I think that could be a good thing to start off. Like, what is it, and what do you kind of have to do?
Well, I think the key idea is that GDPR came about because there was an awareness that there was a lot of data being used by companies and organizations that you had no control. So you actually didn't know what data was being taken and also where that data sat, what was happening to it. So the idea of the GDPR is really where you now have a legitimate right to ask any organization about what data they hold on you, and that they have to give you that data, and you be able to access it and know how that data is being used. That's kind of really, and that was the kind of philosophy behind it. What basically now in more granularity is that the general data protection is basically organizations like a school now have a responsibility to make sure the personal data that we're using and storing is secure, and that we are making sure that we follow a variety of protocols to ensure that if somebody wants that data, we can retrieve it and give it to them and give them a clear understanding of how we're using the data, what are the reasons, what are the legitimate use for that data, and also understand that there's some things that we can't do anymore and some things we can. So GDPR really, I think, is an interesting idea that 27 nations came together and decided that this issue of data, especially in the world of social media and the Cambridge Analytics and Facebook and breaches, all those things, it really is saying we want to empower the individual to be able to have more control of what happens to their data and how it's used, and them having the power to ask and say no, or I want to know where my data is. I don't know, Mark, jump in, because I kind of went on a roll there.
No, that's good. It is confusing as well. I mean, I think even I've been involved in this, and I got the acronym wrong at the beginning. You know, I said privacy instead of protection. Like, it is, the whole thing is confusing as well. You know, that's, I think people don't need to be scared. If it's natural to find it a little bit overwhelming, but I think, you know, when you break it down, it gets a bit clearer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the problem is, this is something new, so a lot of organizations have no point of reference, and a lot of these rules and protocols and laws are something that just come into play. So there are a lot of unknowns, and it seems overwhelming. There's no doubt, if you consider everything that you have to do to become abide by the general data protection, especially for schools with limited resources, it becomes quite complicated. So I think there was kind of a bit of a panic. And I think also a lot of people still, with any legal jargon, get confused actually what they have to do and can do and not do. So I think that sense of panic and that sense of being overwhelmed is well founded. And I think that's where a program like this and this kind of conversation hopefully will give some people a point of reference to maybe look at this maybe in a way that doesn't generate that emotion and feeling of panic.
Yeah, I think there's when you distill it down, really what the GDPR is about is around having best practices around your data management. And I think one of the realizations that I came to rather early on in discussions was, you know, when we talk about some of these things, it's not a matter of if something's going wrong and how much we can build up the walls and the protection around it, but it really, it's a matter of when something does go wrong, how prepared you're going to be. And it can be overwhelming when you start to think about all the potential weak areas where something could go wrong. But I think another one of the sort of guiding best practices is that the response that you take or that your organization takes has to be realistically proportionate to what you're able to do from a resource standpoint.
Exactly. I was just going to say, in the event of a breach, you've got a certain number of hours you have to respond, so you need to be ready to do that, because that's when you get into trouble if you don't follow that protocol in the event of a breach.
Yes, because I mean, I think the way that the GDPR is written and the way you would approach compliance, it's really about demonstrating that you're able to respond to a request for information or request to access data, or you're able to respond to a situation where there's been a breach.
And I think Mark's point is a really important one. This has actually been, I think, indirectly a really good thing, because I think schools for quite a long time, in my personal experience working in different international schools, we have a lot of personal data, and maybe we haven't always been as mindful and thorough about how we protect it, how we store it, how it's shared, who has access. And I think some of these things are just good practice. Of course, there's also now the level where there are fines and it's a law. But I really think for us as an organization, in my current context, it's been really helpful. We have started looking at data very differently. We've realized that we have a lot of data that is not protected. And it's not because it's intended not to be protected. It's more kind of an oversight or just a feeling of laissez-faire-ness about it. So I think Mark's point is an important one. This actually, I think, can and has helped schools to kind of reframe their understanding of the importance of personal data, especially in this age where, you know, when you have people's personal data, a lot of damage potentially could take place.
Definitely. Certainly. And I think that's where the a lot of the dialogue and discourse right now has shifted from one of panic and lack of understanding or searching for understanding to recognizing, as you said, we need to be more mindful of some of these practices. But also, I see what's happening as well is that we're seeing opportunities to streamline what we do, to make sure it's easier to access the information that people need to do their jobs. So it's resulted in a lot of opportunities, I think, as well as we've come around to understanding what it truly is about.
That's a really good point, Mark, because I've come across a few people who said they discovered that actually when they went through this whole process, we're holding really similar sets of data in three places. We don't need to. We could put it all into one place. And by the way, this other data we're holding, we don't need to be holding that. This is a lot of hassle for us. It's not secure and we don't even need it. So we'll just stop, you know, holding it.
And that's really important, this idea of duplication, where you have data in multiple places. And there is a case of a hospital in Portugal that got a fine for €700,000 because they had a patient's information in one database and then somebody copied it and put it in other databases and then it was being changed, but not in unison. And So now you have a discrepancy of the information, and this idea of duplication is really important. And that's something that I think in schools we tend to do is we have a database and then people create their own little islands of databases of information, and often it's not shared, not because of people not wanting to. It's just the way the day goes, and you store all this information on your Excel sheet or in your spread, you know, Google sheet, and then suddenly you forget that somebody else in another part of school also has that information. There's a duplication. So I think that is an important point.
Yeah, John, I think it would be great at this point if we could just, you know, before we get too much into sort of Mark's and your story of how you sort of implemented this, but what are the three areas, like, because you've got here governance, data protection, and cybersecurity, like at a high level, like starting from the top, like what does GDPR cover, and maybe say a few words about each of these, if that's okay?
Yeah, so there are three areas. One is governance. So that means all the systems and all information that support you being able to run a school and administer a school. And so those are the regulations and the rules from your HR office down to your IT team to your grade team. The other one is data protection. So that's the information that you have on individuals, be it parents, students, teachers, suppliers. And the third one is cybersecurity, is how you create an environment where there's security of usernames and passwords and information in your databases. What often people don't realize is that the IT part is only a third, one third of the whole thing. And so often it often was perceived as an IT thing, but it has as much importance for all the paper that you have and all the other information, governance and data protection. So those are really the three big ideas. And what it has generated is there are three game changers, really. One is the controller. So that means now the school is responsible for and has to demonstrate compliance with the different principles of processing personal data. So before, where maybe we had a more laissez-faire attitude, now we, the school, are responsible to ensure that we demonstrate compliance with GDPR and that all the principles relating to processing of personal data. And the other one is data protection, is based on kind of a risk-based and by design. And the last one is now there's sanctions and actual legal enforcements if you don't abide. So those three things really kind of I would classify as the game changers in my perspective.
Great. That's really interesting. And you know, just in terms of, again, sort of high level, I think we were talking before the podcast that it's not just people in the European Union that need to think about this. You know, if you've got, you know, people working from the European Union, even the US, you were saying California And certain other countries are adopting GDPR-like laws now.
That's correct. So California has actually is looking into basically beefing up their data protection and personal data regulation, and they're looking at the GDPR, and they're looking at something that they would do at a state level, not at a federal level. So that's the state of California. It has definitely been very proactive in exploring that. Actual rollout and timeline, I don't know the details, but I know I was just in California, and I was at the spending some time with the people at Apple, and they actually now have a department that's working on that, not only on GDPR, but also looking what that means for them locally.
And is this something that any schools outside the EU are thinking about, do you think, or is it almost all European schools that are really implementing this?
I think it goes beyond the European schools, because again, at the heart of it is these best practices around data management. Often where schools or companies enter the conversation is if they're doing business within the EU, or if they have clientele from the EU, that sort of opened their eyes to, well, wait a minute, where does my responsibility lie to comply with this regulation?
Exactly.
So I think they are getting involved from that standpoint.
Yeah, I heard that, and I was a bit unclear about that, because I heard of some schools and companies outside the EU, and I even heard, which I think is incorrect, that if you have staff members or students that are from the EU, it's potentially some involvement with GDPR, which I'm not sure is true. But I think definitely if you've got suppliers and customers, in the school you're dealing with from the EU, you could be bound by some of the GDPR rules, even if you're not in the European Union.
Absolutely. So if you have students and faculty members that are carrying EU passports, you as a school, they have a right to also have the same protections as they would if they were in the EU. So you as an organization would have a responsibility to abide by that. But I think that, Mark, I don't know, you might be better at answering this, but I think it's still kind of a gray area. And I know some schools just haven't had the time, or they haven't made that a priority just because of the distance from the being in Europe, or the fact that they're not a European entity.
Yeah, I think as long as if you are an EU citizen, you're guaranteed the rights, or you're guaranteed the rights that are sort of promoted under the GDPR. However, at the end of the day, it would be really the final word would be whatever the legal statements are in the country in which you're residing or operating.
Guys,
and the ability of the EU to enforce that in that country would depend on that legislation in that country.
Definitely. But I think a lot of schools are just, like John said, they're using this as an excuse to clean things up and put some best practice in. And partly out of, an opportunity, and probably partly out of fear, because they no one's really sure if they could be,
Well, I think this is where there's a really great opportunity, because I think when you approach individuals and teams about changing practices, it can be potentially a thorny issue or a thorny discussion. But when you're putting it in the context of the GDPR or data protection in general, I think it makes it easier to sort of make apparent the landscape that we're talking about, that we're not trying to make you more efficient or change your practices because you're not doing your job, but actually there are real opportunities here to do what we do better and hopefully improve what you need access to do your job.
Yep.
Yeah, I definitely second that, Mark. I think that's a very important point.
Fantastic. I think, Mark, at this point, it would be great. We've kind of gone over a bit of a high level of what is GDPR. It'd be great to talk a bit about let's talk about the practical nitty-gritty, how you got started setting up GDPR, and then John's going to jump in with his experiences. As we mentioned at the beginning, Mark is in Switzerland, in Zurich, and John is in Luxembourg, so two kind of different countries, so we're going to get a bit of different perspective from different schools.
Yeah, I guess, I'd highlight two aspects of how we approach this. One was building a team to address this, and the second was the specific activities that we started with. In terms of the team, this was very unique because, with the exception perhaps of accreditation, never have we built such a team that really goes right across the entire school. So we had to sort of pull together some heads of departments to work in ways that we'd never necessarily worked together before, or very rarely, on a scale that we certainly hadn't worked together before. And again, the closest thing I can think of is an accreditation activity that would be similar to this. So we put together a team with these heads of departments to sort of oversee the activities that we began to engage in. And the two activities that we started with were data mapping and risk assessment. And so the process of data mapping is identifying all the information flows that you have within your organization that go from one location to the other. And this might be an instance of collecting data, accessing it, managing it, or even deleting it in the end. And so we were trying to identify where all of these actions happen across our entire organization. And then once we'd completed that, we engaged in a risk assessment of these activities. The purpose of the risk assessment was twofold. One, we wanted to know where we were at risk. And by identifying where we're at risk, that helped us to prioritize. Because once you go through the data map and you start to recognize that you may have duplicate sets of data or redundant sets of data, you may recognize that you have you don't have a single source of truth. You've got multiple versions of the same set of data. So it's inevitable that you'll sort of uncover some of these things through the data mapping. And when you go through the risk assessment, what we did is we asked two questions. What's the likelihood of something going wrong with this data or there being a breach? And if something were to go wrong, what would be the impact and the potential risks of that data being breached? And again, once we did that assessment, we recognized that some areas were at a much higher risk than others. So that helped us prioritize our resources and personnel around addressing those areas.
Right. Akin, John, so, did you have a similar go through a similar exercise?
We did go through a similar exercise. And I really want to give credit to Mark because he was really the first one to really engage with this. And we had the opportunity of meeting up at a conference, and that's where really we got to kind of hear Mark's story, and that really encouraged us to follow a very similar structure and flow. So that was extremely helpful having another school already having done it. Mark did all the hard work. We did the same thing, data mapping and risk assessment. And also, I think Mark's point is an important one. We have people involved that maybe generally we don't tap into as expertise, far more of a cross-section. We had parents, we had also members of the support staff, secretaries, various other people in the administrative aspects of the school that often aren't in these kind of committees. And that was really nice, the cross-pollination that occurred. And also the commitment, kind of a feeling that we're all in this together.
So Mark, jump back in. Was there anything else in the process we haven't gotten to yet?
Well, I mean, thanks for the kudos, John. We did get started early, but we took it very, very slowly because what we found is that we had more questions than we had answers to. And as John said, we started having these meetings where we brought schools together, and it was really interesting because it was teams from schools that I wouldn't necessarily run into in the past at conferences. So we were connecting with the administrative sections of the school, admissions people, HR. We had a really good cross section of sort of the business side, and there was a lot of sharing best practice, which I think it was a matter of cooperate and graduate. If we didn't have each other to rely on, I don't think we could have collectively gotten through it in our own organizations without learning from the mistakes, the challenges, and the aha moments that other groups had.
So I think it's important that we kind of give a context. The International School of Brussels last November, over a year ago, got a group of schools together, and we start meeting on a regular basis. And I agree with Mark, a lot of people were at different stages in the process, and it was great to see as people that were maybe much more ahead or behind the kind of sharing of information. And also, I think it mitigated often what I would call some misperceptions or some anxieties. And that was really nice to hear other people having done it or some of the strategies that they used. And we met in Brussels a few times, and then we all met in Zagreb, where 32 schools signed an agreement. Basically, they called it the Zagreb Declaration, that these schools have agreed to work and abide by the general data protection. And we had the chairman of the GDPR out of the EU that was there and some other lawyers from the organization. So I think that collaborative aspect is something that was very powerful. And also, as Mark said, the different type of stakeholders that were involved. I really personally feel that this was a wonderful example of how a group of schools that often work independently and in isolation came together and basically took this massive challenge ahead of them and really work closely in sharing and giving resources. And I found that extremely helpful. And I think it's something that hopefully international schools can do more. But for me, this was really evidence of excellent sharing and collaboration amongst many different schools in many different places, but kind of a common agreement that we're going to help each other and do the best we can. And through these meetings, I think we made a lot of progress. And I think for a lot of smaller schools or schools that maybe didn't have as many resources, it was a wonderful way to tap in to schools like Mark's or mine that have maybe more resources and had already moved ahead and then willing to share our templates and the different strategies that we use. So I think, that idea of coming together when you have a problem as international schools and then working together, this really exemplified, I think, a really good example of that.
Do you think, we talked a bit about the data protection lead. What sort of size of school or business do you think people have to have like a full-time person on that? Do you think for almost every school it's just a role like Mark, you're the data protection lead at ZIS? Do you think it's just a role somebody takes on, not a full-time job?
I think it depends on how well you set up your governance structure. If your governance structure is set up well and people within your organization have gone through or have had access to adequate training, when things are happening that they're aware that, wait a minute, I need to be careful with this, or is there a breach in this situation? Am I handling the data correctly? If your governance structure is set up properly, it should be a lot less work for whoever is the ultimate lead or data protection officer. So for schools, if you're a multi-location school, with large campuses in different locations, they would probably want to consider having a data protection officer that's going to coordinate that across the organization. I think if for most schools, you wouldn't necessarily need a full-time position, again, if your governance structure is in place. If you've set up that structure properly, then you have the processes ready when there is a subject access request or when there is a data breach that will come into play. And people are aware of what those are. It's where you don't have that awareness that you need that one person with the expertise to sort of come in and take control of the situation.
We used a working committee model. So we actually have what we call the GDPR working committee, which is a group of six people. And we kind of make sure things are moving ahead. And then we have a steering committee of board members, parents, and various members of the community that basically when the working committee decides to action something, it goes to the steering committee and the directors there, and then that's endorsed. But I agree with Mark. I think for a lot of schools, the key is how well you can train a larger group of people that can become more independent and have that awareness so they're self-regulating as they're working in their different sections of the school. So I think the training of staff and training of point people is really important. And finding the time, I think that's the other thing. We actually got subs in when we did the data mapping. We had 38 different people doing data mapping, and we actually gave them a couple full days to do it, because on top of the busyness of school and everything else, finding time to do this becomes a real challenge. So we really at the beginning kind of front loaded and said, well, if you're going to be doing this, we're going to bring a sub in and then you can really focus on that. And I think having spent that time at the beginning, really getting this going really is paying off now, because there is a more common awareness in our school community about GDPR because of the training and also people being involved in the data mapping as individuals or small teams.
Yeah, the other thing that's helped as well is that, you know, it is inevitable that there's going to be, you know, some incidences, there's going to be a breach, or there's going to be a situation where there's questions. And I think what's really helpful is sharing those experiences out within the organization to say, you know, this is going on, this is happening, this is how we're responding. So sort of using those to illustrate the governance structures in practice as things are going on that some people might be experiencing, be it a phishing attempt or a series of phishing attempts on emails within the school, or even simple things like people leaving papers at the photocopier and saying, you know, hey, this has been happening again, please be aware of this, be cognizant that, you know, when you are printing these things, that you may have sensitive information there. How are you going to make sure that it doesn't get lost?
I'm curious how long the process was like for this kind of initial project. You said you kind of went slow on it, Mark. I'm curious, and also from John's perspective, like how long did you spend? And it's probably difficult to assess how many hours, but you know, was it a part-time job for you during this process?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think at the beginning, when you're doing the mapping, it's really an exercise in trying to find out what you don't know, because you might have an idea that, well, I've got a data management system that holds, or a server that holds certain data. But as you start asking people what they're doing and how they're accessing it, you might learn that, oh, well, we send out a survey and we get this data here and we keep it in this spreadsheet. So that mapping process was a series of conversations. And as John said, it took some significant time, one, to get the right people together, to educate them about what we were specifically looking for, and then getting them to document what it is. So I would say, you know, that took us probably a couple months to sort of go from start to finish on the data mapping. And it's one of those things that's never really done. You're creating a living document that you're constantly going back to and checking and seeing, is this correct? Is it accurate? Have we added some new processes? Have we taken some things away? Have we changed the process so we need to update it? But I would say at the outset, it probably took us a couple months to get the first round of data mapping under our belts, and then a little bit shorter than that to start to apply the risk assessment to each of those areas.
Got it.
I agree. It took us a good 2 months, and then the risk assessment, and then going back. And I think it's a really important point, is that this is a living doc. You don't go and do your data mapping and then you're done. The fact is, processes and things always change and get updated. So that has to continually be revisited and changed to make sure you're reflecting what the current practice is. And I think that's what has been a challenge for us, is we did the data mapping and then we did the risk assessment and we start mitigating some of the risks, and people were like, done. Oh, we're done. It was like, well, you just started a new process. Now we have to data map, risk assessment, and the same thing. So I think it's a new workflow that becomes part of the day-to-day work of any school, and I don't think it's something you can just shelve. And I think as you develop this and start creating the frameworks and the time to do this, that has to be clearly identified as, where are we going to have time to do this, and how do we ensure we keep this going over a long period of time? And I think for us, that has been the biggest challenge, is just finding the time to keep it going and coming back to it and then revisiting it. So I say it's a lot of work, and I think most of us didn't anticipate the level of time and commitment, and also how important it is. Because if you have, say, a parent writes to the school and says, I would like everything you have on me and my son and daughter, well, do you know where everything is?
And has that happened yet, guys?
We had a faculty member ask an aspect of one of the places we store information.
Right, okay.
And so they wanted to know all the security settings and everything. And I know that it took many, many hours of work.
Sure. I guess the first time, and then as you get a process together in future, you know, it'll get more streamlined.
You hope. Yeah. But the fact is that, you know, when a subject access request, you have 72 hours to respond. And what we've been really coaching ourselves is, when that comes in, then the question is to have that dialogue with the individual. And when they say they want everything, what is everything? Is it everything about the grades, about your personal information, your health records? Because everything could be everything. There's a lot of information on individuals that are in emails, pieces of paper. And, you know, if you think of personal data and in a day-to-day work of a teacher, there's a lot of personal data, grades, comments, emails to counselors, emails to learning support, emails to EAL. It just becomes a monolith. So the question is, what is realistic for you to support that request, and what information actually is requested, I think, is an important step to do. Because if you try to get everything, that I just don't even know how we would go about it.
Sure.
Mark, I don't know your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you have to respond within a certain time frame, but you are allowed to ask for clarity about what exactly they want. to try and dial it down to a specific set of information or documents or what have you. We've had that and it, where it's like, yeah, we'd like everything. And so you are spending a lot of time reaching out to the different areas within the school to collect the information that you need. And there's really only so much that you can do, I think, to streamline that process. But one thing that's been helpful, as we've shared that experience back to our colleagues and our employees here, you know, we've been able to stress, you know, if you're having meetings about a student, don't have a conversation on an email thread because you've just created another location, another source of information. So, you know, one of the things we talked about this year during orientation is for these types of conversations, store the information, store the notes or have the dialogue in the location where you are doing that, be it on the student information system or on the meeting agenda, you know, wherever that discussion is happening, keep the notes and the written record of it in that location. Don't have a side conversation. Don't, you know, keep notes on your desk. Try and minimize the places where you're actually keeping that information. And so people are starting to see that as well, and we're able to use the experience we went through to sort of, again, improve practice to a certain extent, but also simplify where things are. Because as John said, if the question is, I would like anything, that can quickly become quite a complex request.
And I think that's something that has been really helpful for us, is now we are we actually generated as a school a set of new protocols and expectations for faculty and staff of how to do certain things. So especially with email, you know, emailing, forwarding emails, confidential emails, passwords, all those things that, you know, we've done kind of very casually or with maybe not much thought because we've just assumed there's good intent. That's really been an important change for us, is having those clear guidelines for faculty. As Mark was saying, if you're going to write confidential emails or have a confidential meeting about a student, let's centralize information. It's about what can we do to kind of centralize things and make sure we have one place where this is stored, more than multiple places of which half we don't know about. So for us, and I must say, you know, teachers have been very positive and very responsive, and we really have been appreciative of how they've taken this on themselves, because I think they realize as GDPR came in, suddenly every time they went on the web and say they were reading the New York Times or the Atlantic Monthly or the Guardian or whatever it might be, they had to start clicking these things about GDPR, and suddenly it became far more real in their day-to-day life. And I think that really helped it become quite real and important in the context of the school.
I think, it's interesting. You mentioned the timeline of 72 hours to respond to subject access requests. What is it true, if there's ever a data breach, is it you have 24 hours to publicize it? Is that correct?
A data breach, no. The subject access request is when an individual...
No, I know. So, yeah, obviously, it's a separate point I was saying with the data breach. Is it true that you have 24 hours, or is it a longer period if there's anything like that happens?
So when we have a data breach, we make a risk assessment and we have a risk register.
Right.
So we look at the risk. We have a data protection officer who is a member of our community. And so the breach is reported to them, and then they make an assessment of the level of the breach and the risks involved. They write it down in the risk register, and based on that, they might contact the authorities or they might not. If it's a breach that maybe is much smaller and can be contained, then at least there's evidence that was registered. But not every time you have a breach, you have to go to the authorities, as I understand.
Yeah, Mark, correct me. And I just checked, and it's actually 7. And if you do report it, it's 72 hours, not 24 hours, the same as the previous one. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But Mark, what on your breaches, are you reporting everyone?
We haven't reported any, because we haven't had any that we felt were at the level that needed to notify the people involved, that the information wasn't actually wasn't unauthorized. There was no, in the end, there was no unauthorized access. There was the potential for it, but when we evaluated it, it was not the case. I think the other thing to realize is that from the EU GDPR, I think the 72 hours, the clock starts ticking when you become aware of the breach, not when the breach occurred.
Right.
Yeah, that's important. And we've had we've actually had two suppliers, what we classified as breaches, and then we contacted them immediately and through our lawyers and said very specifically what they had to do to mitigate this and to fix it, and they were instantly responsive and fixed everything. I mean, so but we didn't then go to the authorities. We basically worked with the supplier and said, well, you shared this information, and that's absolutely not okay with us by GDPR, blah, blah, blah. This is, you can't do this. You need to rectify this immediately, and we need to show proof of that. And both suppliers were immediately responsive and fixed everything. And we wrote them down as in our risk register, but we didn't go to the authorities because I think it depends on what you define as the risk and, you know, what is the harm or was the potential risk that might occur by that breach. And your data protection officer, his role or her role is to define that and then based on that, follow the various protocols that you mentioned. One was to go to the authorities.
Great. I was curious, as far as you know, have any schools been fined under GDPR regulations yet?
There is a German school where I don't know if it was GDPR or copyright, but something happened with a PowerPoint and some information. And I don't think they got fined, but they were basically sent a letter that the way they were sharing this information, they couldn't. That's the only thing I know of schools. There have been a lot of companies, but schools, I don't know. Mark?
I haven't heard anything about fines specifically. I know that there's been some international schools where constituents within their community have submitted a complaint to the local data protection authorities about about subject access requests. But as far as I know, when the authorities then investigated the schools were able to demonstrate their governance structures as well as specifically what they did in that instance, and that satisfied the authorities, which again, I think comes back to having those strong governance structures and documentation. You mentioned like the breach log. When you've got those things in place, those are marks in your favor, so to speak, when things do escalate to include the data.
And I think it's really important for schools to understand that it's about what your intentions are. Have you really tried your very best to do everything to mitigate these breaches or this loss of personal data? And I know that I attended a couple sessions here in Luxembourg with the data protection office, and they were saying that, you know, when they come in and do an audit or somebody calls them in, they want to see, what have you done? Have you done the best you can with the resources that you have and considering your situation to do whatever you have done to prevent this? And even though you did that, there's still a breach. That is in your favor. It's actually to your advantage to register all these breaches and everything, because at least you're being transparent and being very explicit. There was a breach. This is what we did. Yep. This is how it happened. This is how we've mitigated it. That's really to our advantage as schools. And I know that at this conference here in Luxembourg, when we specifically asked the data protection lawyers, they said that was really a very important aspect, is the intent that you have.
And an interesting point that you both made actually there is it's not actually the European Union that investigates and gives a fine. It's your local country. Your local country has a data protection office.
Correct. Exactly. And they then implement the general data protection, which is interesting because different countries have even, some have less stringent laws, but others have even more stringent laws. And France and Luxembourg have far stricter rules about images than are in the GDPR. So you always have to be careful just not to assume because you're abiding by GDPR, but your local laws also are important, and every country is different in that way.
Great, guys. Well, almost, obviously we've gone a bit over time, but it's been a really great chat. Almost time to close it off, I think. I was going to ask about Google. Obviously, we're all involved in Google and G Suite and everything. Do you have anything you found out about, you know, the compliance? People always say, is Google, is G Suite GDPR compliant, etc.?
Well, I mean, you know, I think there was two interesting things that happened, I guess, on this journey that we've all been going through. One was when the media started to pick up on the fact that there was a GDPR deadline looming. And as John alluded to, you know, when people started to see those check boxes for cookies and appearing more and more and more, that sort of put it into everybody's awareness. The other consideration is that while a lot of, you know, we're talking about what we did as schools, most companies or many companies around the world have had to take this under consideration, and especially if they are doing business in or in the EU or with EU citizens, and Google is no exception. So, you know, they've done a lot of work to clarify how they are GDPR compliant. They've got a lot of statements, whether or not you're using Google personally or you're using Google as an organization.
And I think one thing that we tell our teachers is that Office 365 and Google Suite educators, the both that we use, are GDPR compliant, but our behavior is not within them.
Yeah, definitely. And they should stay within the school G Suite. And you know, once they're on their own Gmail accounts, things get a bit more complicated, you know.
Yeah, and I think separating the professional from the personal, GDPR not, is a really good thing to do as a professional in an education institution, is separating your personal life from your professional life, be it in your social media or, as you stated, in a Gmail suite. I think that's just a good precedent.
Definitely. Well, guys, that was a fascinating conversation. Does any of you have anything you want to add you think we've missed here? No, sounds good. Well, in that case, we'll close it off. It's been a pleasure talking. Thank you for your insights, Mark and John, and I look forward to recording another episode soon.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you, John. Yeah, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Dan. A real pleasure.